Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, January 12th. I am your reader, Dagna, and I'll be reading news of local interest and some sports. We will start with the mini editorial on the front page. And today's mini editorial is written by Steve Shaddle of South Sioux City. And Steve writes, "Our Midwest politicians decrying the violence have forgotten the roots. Chickens still come home to roost." Again, this is written by Steve Shaddle of South Sioux City. The Iowa State Legislature opened yesterday for the 2021 session, and there's a story concerning that. The first story is anti-mask protest marks opening day of 2021 Iowa legislative session. State lawmakers returned to the Iowa Capitol on Monday, with the state still in the throes of the COVID-19 pandemic, to perform their work for this year's legislative session. They were joined inside the Capitol by hundreds of anti-mask protesters. Hundreds of people, few if any of them wearing face coverings, packed into the Iowa Capitol Rotunda on Monday and stood shoulder to shoulder as they protested mask wearing and other public health measures designed to slow the spread of the new coronavirus and the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of the protesters then went to the Senate and House chamber galleries to observe the short opening day set proceedings. Iowa's current public health order requires people to wear masks in public when inside and around others for more than 15 minutes, but those orders do not apply to the Iowa Capitol, where state lawmakers are able to create their own rules of operation. Republicans, who with their majorities in the Iowa House and Senate, determines rules for the chambers, decided against requiring face masks for visitors to the Capitol. More than 4,000 Iowans and more than 374,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, according to state and federal data. The global pandemic has claimed nearly 2 million lives. Iowa's COVID-19 numbers have been falling steadily since a dramatic spike in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths during November and December. However, those numbers recently have started to increase again. Infectious disease and public health experts are in near unanimous agreement that maintaining at least 6 feet of physical distance from others and wearing face coverings are among the best ways to slow the virus spread. Of course, it's concerning any time you've got large groups of people who are not wearing masks. And indoors, you know, there's an elevated likelihood of coronavirus transmission, so that's a concern, said Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, who's a Democrat from Coralville. He continues, "This could all come to an end if the majority would decide that the State House should follow the same rules as everyday Iowans under the governor's public health emergency declaration." The Bureau sought comment or reaction from Republican Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, and the State Public Health Department. As of early Monday afternoon, none had responded. The first day of the session was typically ceremonial, with legislative leaders giving opening day remarks. Walls began his remarks by asking all legislators to stand for a moment of silence and prayer for the Iowans and Americans who have died due to COVID-19. And he shared a story of a constituent, a Coralville U.S. Postal Service worker, who died from COVID-19. Walls said, "We all have stories just like this one in the communities we represent. We will all carry the scars of this pandemic with us for the rest of our lives and as we get back to work for the people of this great state." Whitfer also mentioned the pandemic. He said Republicans' conservative budgeting practices prepared the state to weather any financial storm due to the pandemic and talked about the strain the pandemic has had on businesses and people who lived in or have loved ones who live in nursing homes. "This year, we are focused on putting our state back on a path of success and prosperity after all of these challenges. To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, the best recovery plan is a job. This recovery plan means sticking to those same principles guiding us for the last several years." The headline for our next story is Health Official, 3,450 doses of COVID-19 vaccine given in Woodbury County. Sioux City. As of Monday morning, Siouxland District Health Department Director Kevin Grime said Woodbury County has received 4,400 total doses of COVID-19 vaccine. 3,450 of them have been administered. Grimes said the data does not include vaccines being given to staff and residents in long-term facilities through national pharmacy chains. Siouxland District Health Department is the allocating entity for Woodbury County, so all doses are going to flow through us, except for those that go directly to the long-term care through the pharmacy. We have no control over them, Grimes said during Monday's Sioux City Council meeting. This is a prioritized audience. They are receiving the vaccine as fast as anybody wants that. Grimes said healthcare professionals are still the focus of the county's vaccination efforts and that no doses are being held back at the local level to supply second doses. That's all built into the distribution process, he said. Our goal is always to receive the initial dose and turn it around and getting this out there. Grimes said vaccination clinics are planned Thursday and Friday to vaccinate more healthcare professionals, including rural EMS squads. Hopefully, we will be able to have at least another 800 to 900 doses actually out in the community, delivered, injected into arms by then. Grimes said district health experts expects to have a limited supply of the vaccine for a few weeks as the state seeks to meet its vaccination commitment to long-term care facilities. As few as 19,000 doses for the entire state, but they will allocate that across the way, he said. Grimes noted that he has not seen vaccine flowing into South Dakota, and that Southeast South Dakota residents are calling his department seeking inoculations. This is really a federal asset, so we don't necessarily deny. But in this case, once we get past the healthcare professionals, we are trying to figure out what our strategy is, because our priority is to get Iowa residents of Woodbury County. After healthcare providers, Grimes said District Health is debating between prioritizing those 70 and older or 75 and older. Since the vaccine must be fully administered within 5 days of thawing, he said the department wants to ensure enough people are in the queue. More importantly, once we get the first dose out of the vial, you have 6 hours to get the whole vial used. The Pfizer has 5 doses per vial, and the Moderna has 10 doses per vial, he said. We don't want to have any go to waste. He said, told the council that pre-scheduled vaccination clinics probably will not happen until April, or even closer to June or July, for members of the public who do not fall into one of the priority groups due to their profession, age, or pre-existing condition, which would increase their risk for severe illness if they contract the virus. The headline for our next story, Superintendent, Sioux City School District teachers could get vaccine by late January. Nearly 90% of Sioux City School District employees plan to take the vaccine for the novel coronavirus, and that vaccine could be available as soon as the last week of January, said Superintendent Paul Gausman Monday. Speaking in the Sioux City School Board meeting, Gausman said he's had discussions with the Siouxland District Health Department, who will ultimately set vaccine plan details. Gausman said the next batch of vaccines in the county will likely be available to district employees by the last week in January or the first week in February, based on what he's heard from Siouxland District Health officials. As of Monday, Gausman said a survey of the district's 2,500 teachers, administrators, bus drivers, food service workers, and other support personnel showed 88% said they would take the vaccine. He said the vaccine doses will likely be administered at the three high schools. In response to a question from board member Dan Greenwell, Gausman confirmed the district is not planning to vaccinate the 14,800 pupils. Sioux City Education Association President Chris Snavely, who heads the teacher union group, said the long first semester of giving instructions amid the coronavirus pandemic has been wearing on teachers. Staff burnout is high. We need to make sure our teachers are safe, Snavely said. Board President Perla Alicorn-Flory gave an ovation to teachers, saying they and all school personnel take seriously the task of keeping students safe while giving course instruction. Alicorn-Flory added that community members in January have flooded school board and administrators with opinions on the best method of instruction. The board decided not to alter a decision made at the last meeting of December 14th, when voting that after the holiday break, courses beginning January 1st would resume in a hybrid version of learning for the first 2 weeks of January. That plan was set to lessen any impact of pupils and staff from mingling with friends and family over the break. The setup, which ends Friday, 2 days before the last, before first semester ends, is that half of the district students attend school on Monday and Thursday, while the other half have in-person classes on Tuesday and Friday. The other 3 days, classes are consumed online. Alicorn Flory and other board members said there was no need to lengthen the hybrid model beyond this week, since virus numbers have considerably tapered down. The first week following the resumption of classes after the holiday break showed only one pupil and no teachers tested positive for the novel coronavirus over the first 5 days of 2021. That outcome made for the clearest week since Sioux City School District reporting on the virus began in early September. The Monday meeting marked the first time in several months that board member Monique Scarlett did not push for hybrid learning to be adopted. Based on first semester test scores, Greenwell said, the in-person has been effective. The pandemic impact trend in the district lessened in December. Statistics from December 18th, the last report prior to the break, showed 4 students and 6 employees tested positive, while the numbers the prior week had 12 students testing positive. From early October to December, more than 24 class sections have converted from in-person to virtual learning for 2 weeks, as higher virus numbers showed up in varying schools. As of Monday, the number of positive cases in the county was above 12,700. There have been 173 deaths from COVID-19 in Woodbury County. And in other business, the board members again discussed steps towards setting the 2021-22 budget year. Chief Financial Officer Patty Blankenship said general fund targeted spending will likely be in the vicinity of $178 million for a total budget that will be above $200 million. Gausman said Governor Kim Brundle on Tuesday could announce a target for the amount of supplemental state aid that could come out of the legislature. The potential amount of new supplemental state aid placed into the proposed district budget for 21-22 was 1% and 2%, with scenarios of expenses rising at 2% or 3%. There will be no budget discussions in the next board meeting on January 25th, but it will be a topic in the following 4 meetings in February and March, including March 22nd, when a final review is done prior to passing the budget on April 12th. We'll now move to a story about the city council. The headline is Traffic Signal Street Construction Projects Receive Council Approval, Sioux City. The Sioux City Council voted Monday to approve construction plans for the Sunnybrook Drive and Sargent Road Traffic Signal Project and also greenlighted 4 street construction projects. Councilwoman Julie Shaner said during the council comments portion of the meeting, "We have lots of complaints about potholes and conditions of city streets and water main breaks and things like that. Is this all of the streets? Is this going to take care of it? No. But again, we have 4 nice projects here in front of us that are being approved. It's getting done. It takes time. We've got hundreds of miles of streets to take care of. Today is a great step forward." The street construction projects are the milling of the existing asphalt pavement, pavement patching, asphalt overlay, and construction of sidewalk ramps on South St. Auburn Street and Orleans Avenue. The engineer's estimate for probable construction cost is $262,192.50. The project has an available balance of $1,298,168 and is expected to be completed in July 2021. The other next project is the completion of the milling of the existing asphalt pavement, pavement patching, asphalt overlay, and construction of sidewalk ramps on Chamber Street from Floyd Boulevard to Glen Oaks Boulevard. The engineer's estimate for probable construction cost is $351,125. The project has an available balance of $1,298,168. This project has an early start date of May 3rd and a late start date of May 31st. Work is expected to be completed within 50 working days. The next project is the reconstruction of approximately 1,260 feet of pavement, new sanitary sewers, water mains, storm sewer systems, and 5-foot wide sidewalks on Ingleside Avenue, 18th to 21st Streets. The engineer's estimate for probable construction cost is $1,511,794.50. Additional funds in the amount of $2 million are being requested in fiscal year 2022. The project is expected to be completed in October of 2021. The next project, the 33rd Street Paving Project, Floyd Boulevard to St. Anthony's Place, which includes the paving and installation of a drainable base layer with subdrains. The engineer's estimate for probable construction cost is $787,424. The project has an available balance of $1,298,168. This project is expected to be completed in October 2021. The traffic signal project includes the construction of a traffic signal at the intersection of Sunnybrook Drive and Sargent Road. A traffic study conducted by McClure Engineering showed the need for a new signal at the intersection, which is currently controlled by stop signs. During a January 25th budget review session, City Engineer Gordon Fair said when motorists stop at the intersection at the same time, they don't know who goes first. The engineer's estimate for probable construction cost is $227,660. The project is among those contained in the Capital Improvement Program and currently has an available balance of $317,640. This project has an early start date of June 1st and a late start date of July 6th. Work is expected to be completed within 45 working days. We'll now have an update on the COVID-19 situation in Siouxland area. And the headline is Zero COVID-19 Deaths Recorded in Siouxland Counties Monday. No COVID-19 related deaths were reported by any Siouxland counties on Monday. Siouxland District Health Department reported 27 new cases of the virus in Woodbury County, where the 14-day COVID-19 positivity rate stood at 16.4%. Woodbury County has 12,759 total cases of the virus and 173 total deaths as of Monday evening, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. Across the Missouri River in Nebraska, Dakota County added 19 new cases of the virus. The Northeast Nebraska County had 3,684 total COVID-19 cases and 67 total COVID-19 related deaths as of Monday. Its 7-day rolling average COVID-19 positivity rate is 11.19% on Monday. Crawford County continues to have the highest 14-day COVID-19 positivity rate in Northwest Iowa and the fourth highest in the state at 25.3%. The county had recorded 2,251 total cases of the virus and 22 total deaths as of Monday evening. District Health reported that 46 patients with the novel coronavirus were hospitalized at either Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center or Unity Point Health St. Luke's, which was unchanged from Sunday. Of those patients, 36 were hospitalized for treatment of COVID-19. Another 10 people in the hospital have the virus but are hospitalized for other reasons. Of the total, 20 are Woodbury County residents. IDPH data, which was last updated Monday, shows a total of 490 hospital beds are available in Regional Medical Coordination Center Region 3, which includes Woodbury County and most of Northwest Iowa. RMCC3 has a total of 87 COVID-19 patients hospitalized, down 4 from Sunday. 18 of those patients are in ICU beds, and there are still 79 ICU beds available. The state statistics show 5 ventilators being used by patients, and an additional 98 ventilators are available in the region. The headline for our next story is More Foreign Students Allege Trafficking Forced Labor at Witt Community College. Sioux City. A second group of international students has sued Western Iowa Tech Community College, alleging the school and local businesses use them for cheap labor and fail to provide promised educational opportunities. The students, 9 from Brazil and 2 from Chile, were recruited to the Sioux City School through the federal J-1 student study program and said that they were told they'd be in a 2-year degree program, receive scholarships covering tuition and housing, and be provided with an internship in their field of study. Instead, they said, they were often forced to work more than 50 hours a week at 2 local factories and were told they would be deported or have housing and food withheld if they missed work because of illness. The treatment amounted to human trafficking and forced labor, the lawsuit said. It is hard for me to understand how a public institution could do this type of wrong to a human being, said Roxanne Conlon, a Des Moines civil rights attorney who is representing the students. The lawsuit, filed Monday in U.S. District Court in Sioux City, is similar to one filed in November by 8 students from Chile who were also part of the J-1 program at WIT. The latest lawsuit accuses WIT Community College and its president, Terry Murrell, Tropac Foods, Royal Canin USA, Premier Services, also known as JL Staffing and Recruiting, and other college officials with forced labor and trafficking for forced labor, racketeering, and ongoing criminal enterprise, violation of the 13th Amendment prohibiting involuntary servitude, fraudulent and negligent misrepresentation, unjust enrichment, breach of contract, and infliction of emotional distress. Tropac and Royal Canin are also accused of violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. The students are asking for a jury trial and are seeking an unspecified amount of compensatory and punitive damages. It also seeks a judge's order prohibiting WIT Community College from participating in the J-1 program in the future. Murrell said he has not seen the new lawsuit and could not comment on the allegations contained in it. We look forward to the opportunity to tell our story in court, he said. WIT Community College offered the program for the first time in 2019, and 60 students from Brazil and Chile arrived that summer to study in the school's culinary arts and robotics and automation programs. Through JNL, a Sioux City job replacement service, students secured jobs at Royal Canin, a pet food manufacturer in North Sioux City, and Tropac, a food processor in Sioux City. Through the program, students obtained a J-1 visa through the U.S. State Department. The visa requires that in return for a scholarship that pays tuition, housing, and other fees, students must work at an internship to gain experience in their field of study. The students said the jobs they were given had nothing to do with their education. Those working at Royal Canin said their jobs consisted of carrying 50-pound bags of pet food ingredients or moving 50-pound blocks of frozen meat. Nancy Albrecht of Premier Services, who is named as a defendant in the lawsuit, declined to comment. Officials at Tropac and Royal Canin could not be reached for comment. According to the lawsuit, the students were paid $15 an hour, $7.75 of which was withheld from their paychecks and given to WIT Community College and JNL Staffing as payment for their scholarships, room, and board. Some said they were left without enough money to buy food because the college did not provide the meals it had promised. They said college officials told them to go to a food pantry if they could not afford food. The State Department received an anonymous complaint in November 2019, the lawsuit said, and investigated the program, causing the students to lose their jobs. WIT Community College ended the program in January and asked the students to vacate their campus housing in February and March. A State Department official in November told the Journal he could neither confirm nor deny whether the department has an ongoing investigation into the school's J-1 program. After students and advocates went public with their complaints about the program a year ago, Murrell said WIT Community College had not asked students to pay housing and tuition out of their own pockets. He said a free meal plan was never promised, and the school had failed to clarify that point at the program's outset. He promised WIT Community College would develop a meal plan to provide food to the students. By the end of January, the college announced that all students had been placed in new jobs. The students in the earlier lawsuit said they were never placed in new internships and that on March 13th, they canceled their visas and bought them airline tickets to go home. Some have chosen to remain in the United States. In a March announcement, WIT Community College said it canceled the program because of concerns about the spread of COVID-19. WIT Community College officials named in the lawsuit include Terry Yee, Dean of the International Education Institute, Rosanna Salgado Burright, International Educational Specialist and Recruiter, Julene Albert, Vice President of Learning, James Zucker, International Educational Coordinator, and Lily Castro, Director of Special Programs. I'll now move to some news briefs. Man pleads not guilty to cutting child's head, Sioux City. A Sioux City man has pleaded not guilty to cutting a child's head when hitting him with a potato masher. Timothy Fields, 29, entered his written plea Thursday in Woodbury County District Court to two counts of child endangerment resulting in bodily injury. His trial was set for April 13th. According to court documents, Fields, who was living with a woman and her six children, was watching her four-year-old and seven-year-old on May 18, 2017, when he became upset and hit the four-year-old on the head with a potato masher, causing two cuts that required six staples to close. He also hit the child in the chest with the utensil. Fields is also charged with striking the seven-year-old with the potato masher in the forehead and the arm, causing a cut on the head and a bruise on the arm. According to court documents, Fields fled the area after the incident, and an arrest warrant was issued for him in June 2017. He was arrested December 30th. Woman sentenced to 10 years for shooting son, Sioux City. A Sioux City woman was sentenced Monday to 10 years in prison for shooting her son at their Morningside home. Georgia Grau, 57, pleaded guilty in Woodbury County District Court to willful injury and reckless use of a firearm. District Judge Zachary Hindman sentenced her according to terms of a plea agreement Grau entered with prosecutors. Charges of attempted murder, going armed with intent, and domestic abuse assault were dismissed. Grau was arrested June 5th after shooting her son Thomas Grau inside their home in the 5600 block of Hayworth Avenue. Court documents said that Georgia Grau retrieved a .38 caliber revolver from her bedroom, then went to her son's bedroom and shot him in the abdomen. She left the room momentarily, then returned and shot him in the upper arm. The two had a history of domestic violence and disturbances, court documents said. Man charged with sexual contact with a teenage woman. Storm Lake. A 22-year-old Storm Lake man has been jailed on suspicion of having sexual contact on multiple occasions with a 15-year-old girl. The Storm Lake Police Department received a report at 5 p.m. Sunday of a possible sexual assault and launched an investigation. According to a police news release, Nixon Mendoza Munoz met the teenage girl, who was from Storm Lake, through a social media site about 2 months ago. Mendoza Munoz is accused of having sexual contact with her at homes in Storm Lake in December. He was arrested about 2 hours after police received the complaint and booked into the Buena Vista County Jail on five counts of third-degree sexual abuse. His bond has been set at $50,000. Body found in fire-damaged home identified. Estherville. Authorities have released the name of a man whose body was found in an Estherville home that caught fire. According to a statement from the Estherville Police Department, the man is 69-year-old Paul Ostendorf, who owned and occupied the home at 1414 North 6th Street. Both Ostendorf's cause of death and the cause of the fire remain under investigation. At 3:52 a.m. on January 2nd, Emmett County 911 operators received a call from a neighbor who reported flames coming from a house near his location. Estherville firefighters were able to extinguish the fire, but the house was heavily damaged in the blaze. Firefighters eventually recovered Ostendorf's body from the home. Siouxland man sought by Fugitive Task Force, Sioux City. The U.S. Marshals Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the public's assistance in locating the following person. Alexander Laurel, 20. He is 5'8" tall and weighs 150 pounds. Laurel is wanted by the Northern District of Iowa on a federal warrant for a drug user in possession of a firearm. Anyone with information can call the Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force at 712-252-0211 or email siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, January 12th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It is now time to turn to today's obituaries. Our first one is Cynthia Jojean Scott Forsyth. Longtime Little Rock resident Cynthia Jojene Scott Forsyth died peacefully at her home Thursday, January 7th, surrounded by her loved ones. She was 69. A service will be at 2 p.m. Wednesday at Smith Funeral Home in Little Rock. A large celebration of Cindy's life will be held when it is safe to do so. Service is limited to friends and closest family. It will be live streamed and information will be updated online. Online guestbook at www.smithfamilycares.com. She was born January 29, 1951 in Sioux City, and she moved to Arkansas 43 years ago. Cynthia was a small business owner for many years, operating Kristen Todd Accessories. She designed, customized, and handmade jewelry both for her store and her customers, who loved her unique creations. She had a keen eye for fashion, and she always kept up with the new trends, even up until her death. She had impeccable class and style, and she was always dressed perfectly for the occasion, whether it was a movie or game night, her children's events, riding her beloved horses, or the most fancy of affairs. Cynthia, or Cindy, as she was known to most, began her long and successful career as a bridal consultant in Iowa. When she moved to Arkansas, she was a clothing buyer for Dillard's and later M.M. Cohn. She eventually opened her own boutique. She loved helping people look and feel their best. Her family and friends describe her as an amazing cheerleader for others, always giving generously of herself. One of her favorite memories was when former President Bill Clinton was holiday shopping and asked her to close her store to the public so, with her help, he could privately shop for gifts. Her greatest joy, however, was her family, especially her two grandchildren, whom she adored. Their nicknames for her was T. She was devoted to them and always delighted in all of their accomplishments. T loved to surprise them with special gifts and her favorite things, including teaching them to ride and feed horses, beach trips every summer, and playing games with them any chance she could get. She also had countless nieces and nephews who called her Aunt Tinny since they could not pronounce Cindy. At every family gathering, there was a flock of children who always followed her as she handed out money, gifts, and candy. Cindy grew up in Sioux City, one of seven children. She was a 1969 graduate of Sioux City's East High School, where she was a cheerleader. Her other nickname was Skin, for her porcelain soft skin as a baby and child. Her brothers and sisters describe her as unconditionally loving, never judgmental, and always generous with her time, love, and intention. They recall her practical jokes and Cindyisms, as they called them, where she famously forgot one word of a one-liner, making it even funnier than it was meant to be. She was fiercely loyal, capable of real sacrifice, and a team player with a heart of gold. She left a lasting impression on everyone she met. She and her husband, Robert, just celebrated 25 years of marriage. They loved spending time on their farm, fishing and riding horses. Horses were her other true love. She could train them and relate to them in ways no one else could. Cindy and Robert also traveled many miles on their Harley-Davidson motorcycles with friends, including the Black Hills, and visiting the Black Hills, Utah, Idaho, and many other destinations. Simply put, Cindy was one of a kind. In her later years, she donated her time to teach children, specifically teenage girls, in foster care at the Second Chance Ranch, and learned to make jewelry. It touched her heart and soul. In lieu of flowers, Cynthia's family asked that donations be made to Second Chance Ranch, P.O. Box 901, Bryant, Arkansas, 72089, or you can go to the website www.2cyr.org. Lamar's. Jason Jackson, 46, died Saturday, January 9th. Arrangements are pending with the Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamar's. Cleo E. Soongens, Danbury, formerly Omaha, Nebraska, 80, died Friday, January 8th. Services will be January 13th at 2 p.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Danbury. Burial after the service at the Danbury Catholic Cemetery in Danbury. Visitation will be January 13th from 12:30 to 2 p.m. at the church. Social distancing and masks will be required. arrangements with Armstrong Van Houten Funeral Home of Mapleton. And that concludes the obituaries for today. Our next headline is Reynolds to give annual Iowa Outlook address on Tuesday night. Governor Kim Reynolds is taking her annual condition of the state address from daytime to supper time. In a break with tradition, the Republican governor will address a joint convention of the 89th Iowa General Assembly at the Iowa Capitol beginning at 6 p.m. Tuesday rather than the typical 10 a.m. Iowa PBS will broadcast the speech live, and other news and social media options are available to view online. A live stream of the speech will be available at SiouxCityJournal.com. Reynolds said that because of the year we've been through, she wants to speak with Iowans directly at an hour when more people are home and can watch. The coronavirus pandemic that hit Iowa last March forced her to temporarily shut down schools, businesses, and many normal functions to slow the viral spread. Then the August 10th derecho hit, adding billions of dollars in losses. I wanted to take the opportunity to speak directly to Iowans and try to hit as many as I can, the governor told reporters last week. It is an opportunity for me to talk about what we have been through, talk about how I think we will move through this, and we will come out stronger and better than ever. Not to talk to just the legislature, but to all Iowans about the year that we have been through, she said. I think to really to continue to provide hope about the vaccine and where we're at as a state and what I see moving forward. With Iowa's coronavirus positive cases hovering around 300,000 and deaths topping 4,100, COVID-19 mitigation, vaccination, and pandemic response, along with focuses on education, economic recovery, safety, tax and budget issues, criminal justice reforms, are expected to factor heavily into Reynolds' remarks to legislators, judicial, and executive branch officials and Iowans. Perhaps the most vivid reminder of how the pandemic affects and divides Iowans will be on display for the speech in the House chambers, where there likely will be a patchwork of spectators, both unmasked and masked. House Democrats, citing lax protocols and superspreader potential, indicated that some of their members would be watching the governor's address remotely instead of in person on the floor. It is not an organized boycott or protest of any kind, said House Democrats spokesman Dean Feher in a memo to reporters. On the Senate side, Democrats cited weak protocols in saying they had informed the governor's office they expected to watch her speech Wednesday's condition of the judiciary address by the Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Christensen and Thursday's condition of the National Guard address by Iowa National Guard Adjutant General Benjamin Correll remotely. Against that backdrop, Reynolds is expected to sound themes of optimism, economic rebound, and resiliency, telling reporters we are so ready to turn the page on 2020. In 10 months, Iowans went through a pandemic, civil unrest, a significant drought, and a derecho. A word I think that we use a lot to describe Iowa and Iowans is resilient, she said. The governor said past budgeting decisions and the aid of federal stimulus money for government, businesses, and individuals, with another $1.25 billion in federal CARES Act money on the way, enable the state to weather the pandemic and remain in a somewhat strong but cautious financial position with surplus funds heading into a new round of budgeting. At the same time, she said the economic uncertainty brought on by the pandemic means she won't be reintroducing her Invest in Iowa tax swap proposal, but she will be pushing forward priorities that include a sustainable money source for adult and children's mental health. Reynolds also is expected to address educational challenges that have arisen in managing the COVID-19 pandemic, with a new emphasis on giving parents and students the option to receive 100% in-person instruction safely and responsibly in K through 12 schools amid concerns that student achievement is dropping. I'll now move to the sports section, and our first sports story is concerning high school wrestling. And the headline is West Sioux's Cameron Clark gets 100th win. Ridgeview's Xander Ernst now 26-0. Hey, Warden. All Cameron Clark wanted was to be on a wrestling mat this winter. As a freshman and a sophomore, Clark wrestled for Eleni Bluffs, a program just east of Peoria, Illinois. However, in July, the IHSA, the Governing Athletic Association of Illinois, moved football, volleyball, and boys soccer all to the spring season. Clark was concerned there wasn't going to be a winter wrestling season in Illinois, so his family looked into the possibility of moving. Clark got in contact with the coaches at Legends of Gold, a wrestling club in Beersford, South Dakota. That's how Clark got in contact with West Sioux wrestling coach Mark Van Ort, since many of the Falcon wrestlers train at Legends of Gold. For Clark and his family, it seemed like a good fit. He could wrestle during the winter when his family moved to the Hayward area. His parents didn't even have to find new jobs, as they could continue to work remotely from their new home. Clark, on the other hand, was on the mat on Saturday at the, And so it said they could work remotely from their home. Then since Clark's decision, the IHSA paused the winter sports season back in mid-November. Clark, on the other hand, was on the mat at Saturday at the West Sioux Invite, as he not only claimed the 132-pound title at the tournament, but the junior also picked up his 100th career victory in the process. Getting 100 wins, it feels great, Clark said. I love wrestling. Getting this many wins shows me that the work I am putting into the sport is paying off. Clark is one of four Falcon wrestlers, along with Braden McGrath at 120 pounds, Mikey Baker, 138, and Colin Coldam, 145, to win titles on Saturday, as West Sioux finished in second place with 181 points. Central Lion George Little Rock won the tournament with 226.5 points. After winning the 132-pound title on Saturday, Clark's record on the season improved to 21 overall. He's currently ranked number 6 at 126 by the predicament. Clark's only loss of the season is to Woodbury Central's Bo Klingensmith, a tight 2-1 decision at the Riverside Wrestling Invitation on December 12th. Klingensmith is the top-ranked wrestler at 126 in 1A currently. West Sioux and Woodbury Central are scheduled to meet at a duel on Tuesday night at the Long Lines Family Rec Center. Clark's success in Iowa should come as no surprise. As a freshman, Clark finished as the runner-up at 113 pounds in Class 1A. Clark qualified for the state tournament again as a sophomore, but missed the podium. Not only has Clark learned how last season ended, but he's also pushed by state tournament caliber wrestlers in the West Sioux room every day. Graf has back-to-back third-place finishes and is ranked number 2 at 113 pounds. Baker finished in fifth place as a freshman at 106 last season and has bumped up to 132 pounds, where he's ranked 7th. After claiming fifth place at 132 last season, Coldam is ranked number 2 at 138. Plus, Draven Kraft is a state qualifier, and he was a runner-up of 126 pounds on Saturday. The West Sioux coaching staff have even made some adjustments to Clark's style, teaching him to be more aggressive with his offense. Clark admitted he was more of a passive wrestler beforehand. On Saturday, Clark won 2 of his 3 matches by tech fall. So far this season, only one of his wins has been by decision. The rest have all been by major decisions, techno falls, and pins. When I came here, I was more passive. I wasn't that offensive. That changed quickly when I got here. I've gotten more aggressive. I'm enjoying it a lot and racking up a lot of points, Clark said. I just have to get everything in my head right. I have the mindset that I don't think there is anyone that can beat me right now. Ridgeview's Xander Ernst went into the Christmas break undefeated. After his first tournament after the break, Ernst is still undefeated after another quality showing at the West Sioux Invite on Saturday. Ernst won all 3 of his matches, 2 by fall, to claim the 152-pound title as he improved to 26-0 on the season. The only thing that seemed to slow Ernst down was a bloody nose that he suffered during a semifinal match. It just feels great to come back from Christmas break and compete again and just try and improve every day at practice, Ernst said. We had a duel this Thursday, and this is the first tournament back. I had a pretty good rhythm. The bloody noses mess with the rhythm sometimes, but I feel pretty good. I just want to keep improving. Ernst started to have major success last season. After going 27-12 as a freshman, Ernst went 45 as a sophomore, but he fell just short of qualifying for the state tournament. So he changed up his off-season preparation a bit, and that's helped him to his 26-0 start. I wrestled more in the summer, and I was around some really good wrestlers and really good coaches. I found new ways to push myself, cardiovascular-wise, and try and get in the best shape possible, Ernst said. Last year pushed me a lot because I felt I could compete and hang with some top guys that placed at state. I don't want to leave any stone unturned, and I want to do the best I can to take care of business. While Ernst likes being 26-0, he knows there's work to be done yet. Just three of his wins are by decision, and even though Ernst, who is ranked number 10 at 152 pounds in 1A, has many pins, majors, and tech falls, he knows what he needs to get better at before the state tournament. I need to continue to work on my top game. I need to be able to ride out top-ranked guys. I can't just rely on my feet and getting takedowns, Ernst said. My goal is to be pretty high placing on that podium. And now we're going to Kingsley Pearson's case. Carson's Sujens took care of business on Saturday at the West Sioux Invite. His first 106-pound match only lasted 29 seconds. His semifinal match did go 4 minutes, but he easily won by a 15-0 tech fall. In the championship match, Sujens picked up a 9-0 major decision against Spencer's Gabe Cothran, as the KP sophomore did not allow a point the whole day. The day felt pretty good. The team and I have been working pretty hard this week, and we have a busy week ahead of us. We are going to keep going hard at practice for the upcoming matches, Sujens said. I do my best to take as many shots as I can and work on that a lot. I feel like I am good at that, and that's what I like doing. It's the 12th straight win for Sujens. The first 10 were all by fall before Saturday's 15-0 tech fall and 9-0 major decision. Sujens is 24 on the season now, and he's coming off a 34-12 freshman campaign. However, he fell just short of qualifying for state, losing in the Class 1A District 5 semifinals and then the third place match. Sujens says he's better this season because of the experience he gained as a freshman. First high school year, that gets pretty nerve-wracking, and this year I think I've gotten the nerves worked out and I am ready to compete. My goal is to make it to state and see what I can do there and hope everything works out. Now we have a college football story, and the headline is Two Former Iowa Hawkeyes Elected to Hall of Fame. Two former Iowa football players who helped bring life into long-dormant Hawkeye program became Hall of Famers on Monday. Dominant defensive end Andre Tippett and defensive back Bob Stoops, teammates on a 1981 Iowa team which won a Big Ten championship and played in a bowl for the first time since 1959, were among 13 individuals named by the National Football Foundation to the 2021 College Football Hall of Fame induction class. Tippett was recognized for his play on the field as a consensus All-American, one of 11 players named to this year's Hall of Fame class, while Stoops is one of two coaches being honored. He was selected for his work as a coach at Oklahoma as part of a career which began at his alma mater. Both expressed appreciation for the honor they will receive on December 7th during the National Football Foundation's annual awards dinner. Thank you all. This is amazing. Go Hawks, Tippett wrote on a Twitter shortly after his selection was announced. In an interview with ESPN, which unveiled this year's Hall of Fame class, Stoops said, being the son of lifetime high school coach, I have so much respect for our profession. I feel honored and humbled to be selected for the Hall of Fame. Tippett and Stoops were selected from a group of 78 players and 7 coaches from the Football Bowl subdivision under consideration for the 2021 induction class. They joined 15 other individuals with ties to the Iowa program who have been inducted as either players or coaches into the College Football Hall of Fame, and they are the first Hawkeyes selected for induction since linebacker Larry Station in 2009. Tippett earned his honor one stop at a time. The Newark, New Jersey native was a two-time first-team All-Big Ten selection who as a junior established an Iowa single-season record for yardage when he dropped opponents for 153 yards in losses on the 20 tackles for a loss he recorded in 1980. That school record still stands. The following year, he joined Stoops in helping the Hawkeyes to an 8-4 record and a Rose Bowl berth, the program's first in more than two decades. Tippett, in an interview with Iowa's Athletics Department website, said the personalities on that 1981 team allowed the Hawkeyes to thrive. I knew when I was going down a dark alley with Brad Webb, Pat Dean, Tracy Cocker, Lou King, Mark Bullards, Bobby Stoops, Mel Cole, and Todd Simonson, I did not have anything to worry about, Tippett said. We had great football players and we came to ball. Bottom line, if I had to do it all over, I would not want to do it with any other guys. Drafted by the New England Patriots in the second round of the 1982 draft, Tippett went on to play 11 NFL seasons. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2008 after spending his entire professional playing career with the Patriots. Tippett still works for the organization as its executive director of community affairs. Stoops was a four-year starter in the Hawkeye secondary, earning all Big Ten honors in 1982 during a season when he was named among the most valuable players on the Iowa team. He began his coaching career at Hayden Fry's staff in 1983, filling volunteer and graduate assistant roles before joining Dick Crum's staff at Kent State in 1988. Stoops went on to work as an assistant at Kansas State and Florida before being named the head coach at Oklahoma in 1999. Over 18 years there, he never had a losing record. Stoops won a school record 190 games during his tenure while leading the Sooners to the 2000 National Championship and six Big 12 titles. Stoops earned National Coach of the Year honors twice and was a six-time Conference Coach of the Year before stepping down from the position after the 2016 season. Tippett joins quarterback Aubrey Devine, quarterback Randy Duncan, guard Kelvin Jones, tackle Alex Karras, halfback Niall Kinnick, fullback Gordon Locke, quarterback Chuck Long, tackle Duke Slater, and station as Iowa players inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. With his selection, Tippett will be eligible for inclusion on the Kinnick Stadium Wall of Honor. Established by the Iowa Athletics Department prior to the 2013 season, the other nine players on the Wall of Honor have their name and jersey numbers displayed on the exterior of the press box at Football Stadium. Stoops joins a collection of coaches that includes former Hawkeye player Earl Banks, recognized for his work as a head coach at Morgan State, and former Iowa head coaches Eddie Anderson, Forrest Evesheki, Fry, Howard Jones, and Slip Madigan. We now have some sports briefs. Our first one is Iowa State men's game postponed. Ames. The Iowa State-Kansas State men's basketball game scheduled for Wednesday, January 13th, has been postponed in accordance with Big 12 conference game interruption guidelines. Kansas State was unable to meet the required COVID-19 thresholds on Monday, as established by the league. The universities and the Big 12 conference will work to reschedule the game. Iowa State's next game will be Saturday at Kansas. The game will tip off at 1 p.m. on Big 12 Now on ESPN+. WSC's Jansen collects NCIC honor. Wayne, Nebraska. Wayne State College junior Jordan Jansen was announced as the Northern Sun Conference Men's Basketball South Division Player of the Week. It is the first time this season and third time overall that Jansen has been named NSIC Player of the Week. Jansen, a 6'7 forward, averaged 21 points and 8 rebounds per game while shooting 61.5% from the field and 83.3% at the free throw line. He produced 24 points and 7 rebounds in Friday's 88-76 win over Golden Bears and followed that with 18 points and 9 rebounds in Saturday's 82-60 win over at CSP. For the season, Jansen is averaging 17.5 points and 8.5 rebounds per game to rank 8th in the NSIC in scoring and tie for 3rd in rebounding. He is shooting 52.9% from the field and 72.7% at the charity strip and needs 26 points to become the 36th player in school history to reach 1,000 points at Wayne State. Wayne State, 2-2 overall and 2-0 in the NSIC South Division, hosts Minnesota State Friday evening at 6:30 and Saturday afternoon at 2:30 in Rice Auditorium. SDSU men's game canceled. Brookings. The South Dakota State men's basketball team's games scheduled for Friday and Saturday at Omaha have been canceled in accordance with the Summit League COVID-19 protocols. The Jackrabbits, 8-3 overall and 7-2 in the Summit League, are now slated to resume action January 22nd against North Dakota. This weekend's women's basketball games between SDSU and Omaha remain on schedule. Tip-off is set for 3 p.m. both Friday and Saturday at Baxter Arena in Omaha. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, January 13th. It's January 12th. I'm your reader, Dagna, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you so much for listening.